Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to have Sue Peters-Hawk here to talk about her latest book. We have called the topic of tonight's talk The Hazel Hawk Story, and I'll introduce our speaker briefly because she's well known. Sue Peters-Hawk is a speaker, a writer and a consultant. She's been an activist, and still is, for dementia reform, and she also co-chairs the Federal Minister's Dementia Advisory Group and is inaugural National Ambassador for Alzheimer's Australia. She has two grown children and she lives in Sydney, and this is her first appearance at the Sydney Institute, not long after the publication of Hazel, My Mother's Story, by Sue Peters-Hawk. And as I said, tonight's topic is The Hazel Hawk Story. Sue Peters-Hawk, you're welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. I should just... funny being Valentine's Day, isn't it? It sort of doesn't really seem very serious to me, but I've just been down in Canberra at a function and there were these little red hearts everywhere all over these rooms in Parliament House, which seemed a bit funny because it's not a place you really feel a lot of love a lot of the time. But thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here. You're a famous institute. I should say at the beginning that writing this particular book was not my idea, because you would think, surely, that writing one book about their mother would be enough for anybody. Why would you do a second? But Tom Gilliatt, the senior publisher of non-fiction at Pan Macmillan, raised it with me. He approached me with the idea, and I was intrigued, I must say. As he pointed out, Hazel's Journey, my first book, was very specifically the story of a journey with dementia. It was about that aim to cast light and to open up that subject. It wasn't a biography or a reflection on Mum's life as a whole. And Tom felt strongly that the whole story would be one worth telling. And although it just simply never occurred to me, as I turned the idea over in my mind, you know how sometimes somebody puts an idea in there and it hooks you and sort of doesn't go away? I found myself agreeing with him. But agreeing to write something is one thing, actually doing it quite another. The ensuing year and a half or so have been really intense. I mean, on the one hand, the work of creating a book, any book, is no walk in the park. But if you add to that the bittersweet nature of intensively researching your own mother's life, and of doing that while she's still here with us, but lost to us in some ways as she lives with her advancing dementia. So it's been a very intense and at times quite an emotional process, but one with a happy ending, so to speak, because I have to say that I've emerged from the undertaking feeling re-inspired about Mum, about Hazel, all over again. Because there's no doubt, if there ever was, that Mum's life has been fascinating. Whether this book does her life and her legacy justice is for others to judge, but I can vouch for the story. In it, we follow her from her happy childhood in pre-war Perth, really a sense of a world that is just no longer available to us, that doesn't exist anymore. From that, through a very happy childhood and very engaged time with family and neighbourhood and church, through a jam-packed and busy time, always been busy, my mother, is one of the things that became really clear, busy time as a teenager and a young working woman, to the life-altering romance with my father, which is where the script went off track to a fair degree from what expectations might have been, and I'll talk about that later. Off to Oxford together, to Canberra, and then to Melbourne, as they established their partnership and their young family. We're not so young now, but we see how exciting and rewarding and challenging and sometimes, you know, heartbreakingly difficult and lonely these early years were of her married life were for her. But then, in the context of significant social upheaval, intense political events, and the emergence of feminism, we see the massive changes and growth that Mum undergoes as she charts a course of reinventing her place in the world. She liked her place in the world and she wasn't rejected. She loved family life, homemaking. She brought an enormous intelligence and motivation and humour and warmth to that. She didn't have anything against all of that, but for a long time she'd wanted more, which hadn't seemed to be available. So the emergence of feminism fitted very well with her looking for something more, not to reject what she had, but to extend and to embrace more. She charted this course of reinvention, really, through her return to meaningful work, through tertiary education, which she embarked upon at the age of 50, and through a deepening involvement in the world of community work and issues of social justice. People sometimes think that Hazel all of a sudden was discovered or invented herself or whatever when Dad became Prime Minister. But nothing could be farther from the truth, because everything I've just talked about happened well before that time. But once that happened in 1983, and once Mum did register over the course of those first few months, that first year, once she registered as our First Lady, to borrow an Americanism, she did so with a vengeance. And the story from that point on will have elements of familiarity to many of you, I imagine. For example, in particular, the way she worked incredibly hard during those Canberra years to keep contributing, albeit now on a larger scale, to so many facets of our life as a nation. Without ever setting out deliberately to do so, she became known, respected, and indeed loved by many, as she became perhaps the most activist interpreter we've yet seen of the nebulous role of spouse to the nation's leader. She blazed her own trail as she travelled the country, speaking up wherever and whenever she could for the things that she felt mattered. And it's a long list of things she felt mattered, and the more she learned and the more she exposed to, the longer that list grew. But foremost amongst the issues she worked hard for were choices for girls and for women, which we can forget, were way less and way less accepted and sort of available in a reliable way, even then, only like 20, 25 years ago than now. So choices for girls and women, protecting and nurturing and appreciating our environment, nurturing families and family life, did a lot of stuff with kids, all sorts of issues to do with kids. The rights of our Indigenous Australians, promoting music and cultural expression and diversity, and advocating fearlessly for initiatives to protect, support and empower the needy and disadvantaged amongst us. And her post-Canberra life has been equally rich. There was, of course, the well-published separation from my father following their move to Sydney, but you might be unaware of, perhaps unaware of how quickly she overcame that little glitch and successfully went on to yet again reinvent her life afresh. And she was, as she said herself, going great guns again. When the dementia then started to make itself felt, but very importantly, she continued her feisty participation in life for years, despite the limitations that it did increasingly impose. She fought it. She was determined not to succumb to the disease that she famously dubbed the Big A, any more than she could help, to continue enjoying her life, her work, her friends, her garden, her family, for as long as she possibly could. And she was not at all reasonable about it, I can tell you. But I think it's a good illustration of how there's something to be said at times for being unreasonable, because perhaps it's just a matter of refusing to meet expectations, which are in themselves unreasonable, such as you have dementia, you go quiet, you disappear. But however you cut it, she simply stubbornly refused to curtail her sense of who she was or what she was capable of doing, despite the very private anguish and frustration that she was also feeling at times. And in the book, I do my best to create a vivid sense of the realities of my mother's life, the people, the influences, the times, the mores, the attitudes, all that helped create and shape the person that she became and ongoingly evolved as, and the things that she then started to intersect with and perhaps in some small ways influence herself. But in that sense, it can be read very much as a social history as well as a very personal one. It's a funny business, you know, you live a life, you just think about it, you know, you're born, you live, you die. It sounds very linear, but there's nothing at all linear about a life. It's so multidimensional and so much a matter of interpretation and view and emphasis to thoughtfully try to shape that to something that fits between the covers of a book, has a beginning, an end and a decent narrative to it is actually quite challenging. And you find, of course, as you're thinking and approaching it, you find yourself reflecting on what do you think might be some of the important narrative themes, and then they emerge and shape further as you write and intersect with the material and the interviews and the source material you uncover. And it'd be interesting to see what some of you might think are the interesting narrative themes of the book if you were to read it. But let me mention two or three that stand out for me as being of importance. And I think the first and foremost is the changing role of women. I mean, my mum's, I think, recently turned 83. And in the 80-odd years of her life, you could argue, perhaps, that the lives of women have changed more than at any other single 80-year period in history. It's really actually quite stunning when I look at the world my mother was born into and the world that her granddaughter confidently lives in now. And it made me revisit my ideas about feminism a little bit and think it's a pity it's become a dirty word, you know, because I think really all it ever meant, if you strip away all the pejoratives and all the things around it, is the proposition that one's opportunity for education, for choices, for respect, for crafting a life of value and meaning and contribution, the choices that are available to you should be equally open to anybody and not, you know, curtailed or forbidden to people by virtue of gender. But the world that Mum was born into was one where it was a very loving world, it was a very affectionate world, but it was a world of very tightly held boundaries. And that wasn't just about gender, there was all sorts of influences, and I look at that in the book. It was a world of staying safe, of doing what was known, what was expected, of living in a world of enmeshment, of contribution. And, you know, it could have been expected that Mum would have followed the expected. She wanted to go on to higher education and was told, no, that wasn't on. You go to work, you earn a living, help support the family, and then the unspoken bit being, of course, that you meet a nice man, settle down somewhere nearby and have children, and it all happens again. Well, the nice man happened to be my father, and that wasn't the script. but I think allied to that is it really took me into reflecting again on the changing nature of marriage and families. What we expect of partnerships and institutions, that's in the news at the moment for other sorts of reasons, but what we think marriage and partnership is, what the attitudes, both conscious and unconscious, that we bring to raising children, the future we speak of to them and for them, the values, what do we think is important for our children to strive for, and how families are configured, and the simple stuff of who does what, all those sorts of things have, again, changed so dramatically in the period of Mum's life. And I think that's one of the threads, in a sense, that does weave through a little bit. Another thing that struck me, and that I hadn't expected, I mean, I'd anticipated that one of the narrative themes would be the changing lives of women, because that was such a personal one for Mum. But in looking at where my parents came from, each of them, my mother grew up inside neighbourhood in the Congregational Church. My father grew up inside what I like to call the twin churches of the Congregational Church and the Labour Party. And they came from a world where service, where contribution, where looking for your fellow man. I remember once asking my grandfather, Dad's dad, who was a reverend in the Congregational Church, I remember once asking him, Grandpop, you know, what is it about the Congregational Church? What's different about them? What's different from the Catholics or the Presbyterians or whatever? I was, you know, a kid, but I wanted to know. And he said, well, darling, in the Congregational Church, you love God by loving your fellow man. And it's an answer that's always struck me and stayed with me. And it's a heritage, I think, that my mother and father have displayed throughout their lives, even though, as I talk about in the book, the process of them becoming agnostic. I think it just segued to a very rich humanitarianism, in a sense, on both their parts. But I was struck, and also then looking at times out of... When Mum and Dad moved to Melbourne, I was, I think, about 16 months old or something, and Dad moved to become the research officer and advocate for the ACTU and went on to become its president before he went into federal parliament. So we grew up in that milieu of advocacy, of people working on behalf of others. And, you know, trade unions have also become a bit of a dirty word. But in the world that I grew up in, it really was about people looking out for each other and trying to ensure decent conditions and lifestyles. It was very much about looking to see that their children could have better opportunities in life. So, and again, it's a little bit like feminism, I think. It's a pity it's got a dirty word, and I understand to some degree why it has. But a lot of the things we take for granted in the civilised world, such as universal access to education, no child labour down the mines, all these sorts of things, are all things that organised labour has fought to establish at times along the way. And I also look at this cynical disregard in which so many of our politicians are held, and whilst I know some of them do a good job of earning it, I suppose I was taught to respect, and I do respect, and I've watched people who work in public life, and regardless of what you might think of the views of any particular politician, and you know, I reserve the right to disagree vigorously, as I do with many, I respect the fact that they put their hand up, because what they're doing is saying, I care about this country. I think the decisions we make, the things we institute, the way we spend our taxes are about our values as a nation, and I'm happy to, you know, to work in that domain as my life work. And so I have a lot of respect for people who put their hands up for service and for leadership, and I think it's a terrible pity and degrades democracy that we're just automatically cynical rather than being a little bit more critical and supportive. You know, I fear sometimes that it descends a little bit into maybe us getting what we deserve. But anyhow, it's not something I harp on at all through the book, but it's one of the things that struck me in writing it, because I suppose I've had a life that has exposed me and inclined me towards respect for people who work in that domain. But as well as the serious and important stuff and some of the difficult issues Mum encountered and that we've encountered, I've also been very concerned to show in the book and when I talk about it or represent our life that there's been an enormous amount of love and laughter in our family and with friends. You know, we've been privileged with some fabulous experiences and amazing opportunities for insight, and some of those I've shared in these pages. I also talk a lot about Mum's love of music, such an important thing in her life from her early childhood through to still now. It's always been one of her greatest joys, and if you ever asked her what her favourite thing in the world was, she'd say making music with other people. She just loved it. She loved that process of making music together. I also, you know, both my parents have great senses of humour, very different, tend not to laugh at each other's jokes, but both very robust senses of humour. They're both a bit cheeky and a bit irreverent. Both are glass half full kinds of people. And so having fun was definitely a real feature of our family life, you know, as well as some stuff that wasn't fun, but you know, all pretty normal really, isn't it? I also recalled while writing that Mum believed in her matter-of-fact way in ghosts and would tell us kids with no sense of embarrassment, but not when other people were around, about a couple that she'd seen. And in the book I describe a hilarious séance we once had for a bit of a lark upstairs in the attic of the lodge, where we attempted to summon the ghost of John Curtin, who died at the lodge whilst in office, and who some suspect of still haunting the place. But if you want to know what advice he gave us, you'll have to read the book. When people talk to me about Mum's legacy, funny word that, legacy, They often refer to her courage in coming out with dementia and her determination to help fight stigma and to raise money for research. And there is no doubt that she has contributed significantly to a slow improvement in our understanding of dementia and our support for people living with it. But she would be the first to say, it's one of the cruel ironies of the disease that she can't, isn't it? That we have a long way yet to go. And we are actually, in fact, now at a critical crossroads in Australia in the context of the Productivity Commission report and various other things. We've got a chance to advance now desperately needed dementia reforms in the context of ongoing healthcare reform and impending aged care reform. It's the opportunity, I believe, to implement a robust approach to research and to risk reduction and to revolutionise our attitudes, our services and our care for people living with dementia and for their carers. Dementia is one of those diseases, there's much more of it than people know, I won't start throwing figures at you. But it's one of those diseases with a big multiplier effect in terms of family and carers of its impacts. We need to be doing that both now and for the future ahead of us as numbers blow out. And if this is an issue of interest to you, I would urge you to take a look at the Fight Dementia website set up by Alzheimer's Australia and perhaps to show that you care by registering as a dementia champion. But I'm enormously proud of Mum's contribution in this field, no questions about it. But I would also make a plea here that it not be allowed, just as you don't want anybody's struggle or disease at the end of their life to overshadow your sense of who they are in their whole life. I don't want this to overshadow her wider legacy. As to what precisely that may be, there is of course no one answer, and I explore it a little bit towards the end of the book, and I'll refer here to a friend's comment that I quote in it. Our friend Prue Watson, who helped me run Mum's office for many years, said, "She was a leader. And by leader, I mean that you inspire people to open up and to take on something that they wouldn't normally take on. She used her position in office to contribute. And she did touch people in all the things that she was passionate about. Women's issues, education and Aboriginal issues, music, all those things. She had an appeal across political boundaries, and I can testify to that. The number of emails I get, I mean, it's so moving, the stream of emails I get about Mum. And the number of people who say, don't like Labor, or don't like your dad, or never voted Labor, but I think your Mum's love. Yeah, it's very heartwarming, the diversity of warmth towards it. So she had an appeal across political boundaries, said Prue. So she was a leader in that sense of offering the humane way of seeing things, of appealing to people's better judgments. I think her ability to do that is her legacy, and her generosity of spirit and her humour. She was very much loved, said Prue. Or, as I suggest myself, because I was sort of trying to grapple, I had this feeling that I should try to close the book round out with a sense of a personal reflection on Mum's legacy to me, or my sense of her legacy, and looking to what that wider legacy might be. I was grappling with it, and I realised that really there's not that much difference. You know, that sense, strange as it may seem, of her legacy to me personally and of that wider legacy are surprisingly similar. There is, of course, an important, or a difference that's important to me, one of scale and of intimacy, all those little things, but it's not one of substance. She was my rock. Yeah, kind, loving and loyal, generous and feisty. She always supported and encouraged. Yet she could also challenge us quite vigorously. She would challenge us to be our better selves. She would demand or cajole, whatever. She's the one who held our family together, who believed in us all when we were sometimes not so kind about each other. Because of her quality of always valuing positives over negatives, of seeing the best in people and in situations, of looking to see, very, very practical, what would make the difference? What could be done? Was it step in and wash the dishes, or was it pound the table, or whatever? You know, she just had an immense quality to see what could be done here to pull something through to the best of what's possible. but she was simply never indifferent. She cared. And I believe that the value, the importance of this kind of legacy is worth our attention more today perhaps than ever. In one of Mum's last big speeches at Curtin University in her beloved Western Australia, her main theme was, what kind of country do we want Australia to be? She spoke about the effects of economic policy on individuals as well as on society as a whole. She said, notions such as acceptable levels of unemployment, of the undeserving poor, of zero tolerance, creep into public debate and into the mindsets of some of those who are confident that they will not be on the receiving end of such nostrums. She spoke about the need for us to become a wise country, not just a clever one, saying, in most human cultures over the ages, wisdom has been the most valued and respected of commodities, as embodied in the images of the wise woman or the good wizard, the sage tribal elder, people who are inclined and able to see their community as a whole and to provide advice and leadership and support for the benefit of the whole community. But in our technological age, the notion of wisdom, she said, as a high virtue, has been usurped to a very large degree by the narrower, more sharp-edged concept of cleverness. What I am trying to say here, she went on, may be dismissed by some as irrelevant or warm and fuzzy, but that in itself might be seen as a symptom of the problem. There is actually nothing wrong with warm and fuzzy. It's a jolly sight better than cold and abrasive. It is welcoming, it is inclusive, and when it is built on a foundation of common sense and wisdom, it can also be sustainable. Essentially, she said in closing, what I'm arguing for is to reassert the place of social policy alongside economic policy in national debate and national priorities and national and community values. We must look forward, we must seek, we must hope, but we must do this in a spirit of compassion and with a sense of inclusion. The whole of this nation, in all its diversity, must be on board. And I would add nothing really other than to say that rereading this speech, it just really resonated for me. I find these words from only 12 years ago a really timely reminder given the nature of so much of current political discourse, which often seems to blindly assert economic management as a value divorced from human outcomes. I mean, what's the economy about? Seems to get lost too often in the dialogue and the conversations we have. And too often this spirit of compassion and sense of inclusion that Mum both advocated and I think for many of us embodied, it just seems so sadly lacking too much of the time. But Mum believed that the past is for learning from, not for clinging to. That change is not to be feared, because it is, as she would say in one of her funny turns of phrase, one of life's inevitables. And she showed, I think, that it's up to us, that we can deal intelligently with change as we confront openly and honestly both the challenges and the opportunities that life is always in its nature going to present us. It's up to us to treat each other with care and compassion, to look out for others as we care well for our own, and to take seriously the proposition of living well as a community. It's simply up to us to turn our hearts and minds in that direction. And that, I believe, is Mum's legacy and what she really was all about. So that closes my formal remarks.
Many thanks. Okay, let's go here.
Go here.
So thanks to Faith Nutt for the use of this facility today on Valentine's Day.
Should I sit down?
No, I won't be long.
Okay.
Janet Grundy's got copies of Hazel, My Mother's Story, down the back, and I'm sure Sue Peters-Hawke would be happy to sign the book. And so we come to the questions and discussion. I'm going to call everyone, and someone's going to run around with the microphone, but we'll all be in order. And I don't know a lot about the Congregational Church, which both your parents belong to, but I do know that Malcolm Muggeridge said that the Anglicans approach the Ten Commandments a bit like an exam paper with only eight to be attempted. and thinking about your father and the eight that he might have attempted, I recall a certain sort of surprise, and I know you've covered this in your book, in Living in Melbourne in 1971, when the word was announced that Bob Hawke had been announced Victorian Father of the Year.
Yes, I do cover it.
And you might just tell us about your mother's reaction to that.
I could do no better than to turn to the page if I knew it off by heart, but I don't know my own book that well. But essentially, she was seriously unimpressed. The degree of time and attention that he gave to being a father was a matter of serious conflict between them at times, and it had been in the period leading up to that. I talk in the book about how periods of tension and so on in the family and between them tended to be cyclic, and we happened to be in one of those periods when this was announced. God knows how it happened. I might have known at the time, but I've forgotten. But no, it wasn't uncommon for on a Friday night, or if there was something special on for after school, for us to go in with Mum and us kids would drive in and meet Dad, usually at the John Curtin, the hotel, which was the watering hole next to the ACTU and across the road from the Trades Hall Council. And we knew that back bar well, and we'd sneak into the main bar half the time and have our raspberry lemonades up at the counter. But Mum didn't take us in that night. She put us in a taxi, and we watched Money very carefully, so this was like, whoa. And I remember picking up on a sort of attention. And one of the many people I interviewed in the course of researching this book was Ralph Willis, Ralph and Carol Willis. And they recall that night because we went in and the press take the photos, the happy kids, and the father being the good father and all that stuff. I think if it had been a few years further on, we would have refused to participate, but we were young and naive enough that we did. But then I think we'd stayed, and then Dad had sent us home in a taxi, I think, I can't remember. Anyhow, he said to Ralph, I think you better come home with me, I might need a bit of protection. And Ralph said to Carol, who he was then dating, yeah, I took Carol as my protection. And when they got home, Mum did give Dad a big serve, Father of the Year, my etc. She wasn't impressed. And Dad has acknowledged in a more serious vein that he wasn't, you know, an attentive father in many senses, and he's expressed an open regret about that. So it's not something that I beat him up with now, you know.
What's he like as a grandfather?
He's nice as a grandfather. He's not a small talky person. He's really comfortable in front of a camera and with crowds and stuff. He's not the sort of person who enjoys sitting around a dinner table for ages or chatting. But you get to know your parents, you know how they are, you accept them, and Dad's never going to be one of those people with attention to detail or all the little things. But he loves his grandchildren very dearly. My son's about to go off to the other side of the country for his first job as a pilot, and we had an afternoon tea to farewell him on Saturday, and Dad and Blanche were around and a few other friends and Ben's godfather and stuff, and Ben and Dad sat there chatting away because, you know, Dad was learned to fly planes with the RAF in England when he was there on his Rhodes Scholarship, and he's always fancied the whole flying thing, so he's really chuffed that one of his grandsons a pilot. So, look, he's certainly not the sort who'd have them for a day or do all that hands-on grandparenting, but he's a loving grandparent in his own way. Yeah.
It seems to me, looking at the lines of Prime Minister's particularly Malcolm Fraser, who preceded mm-hmm. Paul, the Hawke family, Bob Hawke, Hayes Hawke, were the first of the, you know, truly ordinary Australians to inhabit the lodge, except perhaps for the Lyons family, but that so far doesn't matter. Mm. It humanised the idea of prime ministership, and a lot of the saddest things about the family sort of got flashed out into the public arena mm-hmm. in the same way as all the good things flashed out. So how was it living in the fishbowl? And I know you go through a lot of this, but just give us some of the...
Sure. Well, the thing I point out is that my growing up was not done with Dad as PM. My growing up was done with Dad as, you know, trade union advocate and researcher. And by the time I was I was a scholarship kid at one of Melbourne's most conservative schools. Dad had a profile as this terrible, rabid communist who'd steal their money and their daughters, both, probably. I grew up in perhaps a slightly, not as fishbowly, but quite different environment to that which later took over as he became more known and, you could assert, more popular or whatever. By that time, I had my own young family. Both my kids were born while Mum and Dad were in Canberra. And I strived to lead just a normal, daggy family life. That's what I wanted for my kids. And that's what they had. And so, you know what it's like for kids, when they visit their grandparents, it's just whatever their life is what's normal to them. It's only later that they get a perspective. So, they had what they now see was the privilege and the interest of, spending time hanging out at the lodge and Kirribilli House and access to all those sorts of things. But it didn't change the life we led particularly. I think what it does do is give you insights into something of the lived reality of the political life. One which, as I said, inclines me towards respect for the nobler aspects of that and an appreciation of the constraints, I think, that people face. How hard it is for anybody to get anything done. How much there is to admire when people do come up with good policy that has, that they get implemented and have good results. So I think opportunities for insight, you meet interesting people, you hear interesting gossip, but if you're not... I get bored by gossip. So obviously it was a dimension. I think the thing that really stayed with me is that sense of appreciation for living a life of contribution, that you, of course, not only see in politics, you see throughout our community, but it left me with an abiding respect for that.
There's a question down here. Yeah, just hang on 1 second.
Very interesting talk. Is it on? Oh, very interesting talk, actually. Did your mum have much influence on what your dad organised in terms of when he was Prime Minister? Did she sort of have much influence on his decision-making processes, the way he sort of discussed these things that he wanted to change within the Australian society, or was it much more his idea than sharing it with?
I think in an overt sense, it was perhaps more him. But as I try to portray in the book, I think theirs was such an engaged partnership, certainly through its early years, and despite its difficulties in some ways, for its entirety, where there was an alignment of values, a conflict of personal and lifestyle values to a degree, but in terms of bigger picture values, very aligned values. And so I think Mum had not been exposed at all to the ideas of the Labor movement or of politics at all, particularly of those key debates in her growing up. But her intelligence and her interest in people took to that like a duck to water, and so she came to have her own views and be part of those discussions. I think, as he admits, he was very slow to be influenced by the one thing strikingly that he could have listened better about, which was the emergence of women wanting more respect, more opportunities outside the home, all those sorts of things. He was a bit of a dinosaur that way, but typical of his generation. I think you can't individually condemn him. I certainly find I can't in looking at it in context. In Canberra, she took the view that she was not an elected representative. It wasn't her business to interfere as such. But in discussions amongst colleagues or whatever, she would always happily express a view. So does that sort of go to what you're asking? Yeah. Yeah.
There's a question over here.
I found your book the talk very interesting.
Thank you.
And I haven't read the book, but I'm just wondering whether you present Hazel in your book as a really human light, expressing her strengths, which I've heard, and her flaws as well.
Mm-hmm. you'd perhaps be better off asking somebody else that than me, but, well, the approach I took, I say in the introduction up front that it's not an academic work. I crafted it not to dumb it down, but to have it be accessible in language and story. I try to deal with concepts and with certain degree of analysis of her character, but I also don't apologise for the fact that it is a loving portrait. It doesn't pretend a fake objectivity. I mean, what would be the point? I'm not objective, so why fake it? In a sense, I think I'm probably a little bit more obvious about the things I admire about her, but I think very implicitly you can see the things that you could call weaknesses or things she was slow to grasp or avoided or whatever. And I think, in a sense, you'd have to make your own judgment after you read it.
There's a question there, yes.
Thank you for your talk. I hope you don't mind me asking this question, but...
Ask away. I'll answer or not, depending.
How is your dad coping with your mother's condition as all
the He's incredibly saddened by it, yeah. Very. He through the years where I cared with her at home, whenever I saw Dad, he'd ask how she was and if there was anything he could do. And similarly, when we had to move her into care, and I let him know if I've seen her recently, you know, how she is, especially if I've had a good visit and she's good. But he's just incredibly saddened. He did say once when we were talking about it all that he said, don't know if I should say this, but I don't see there's any reason why not. He said, you know the thing I hated most when I was Prime Minister? I thought, God, no. And he said, I hated the visits to old age homes. I just found them so sad. You know, because Dad's a softie. He's a big, fat softie. And it's sad. It's really sad. And so he's sad about it.
Question here? Yeah.
Does your mother have access to a piano?
We moved a piano out there when we moved her. We chose a facility that's further away from me than I had intended, but it's run by an organisation that have the courage to really do dementia care differently and better, I think, than is our average. And very open to all sorts of things. So we moved a piano out there, and she played it a lot at first, and it declined, and the quality of her playing, of course, declined, but... It's only the last 6 months or so that she stopped playing altogether, but for the first year or... God, how long is it now? First year or two there, it was a big influence. And still, although she can't play anymore, we make sure there's music on around it. We've got a lot of classical CDs, and I'm always reminding the staff to flick them on. And you notice her responding to music. You can sit and hum, and, yeah, music's still in her.
There's a question here. Oh, just hang on 1 second.
Look, congratulations. I think you're quite amazing, as I do your parents as well.
Thank you.
Can you tell me what's so different about the nursing home that your mum, or the care that your mum's receiving mm-hmm. at the moment, and how you feel it makes a difference to her and to the others who mm-hmm. care, as against the mormon?
Mm. Oh, there's so many ways to answer that. I mean, I think we have the... Well, it's just the misfortune of history, in a sense, in that things evolve from what's been before. And the form of our aged care has evolved, in a sense, from the models of bedlam and the workhouse and the poorhouse and so forth, models of of institutionalising people. And there is no doubt that some people, as they age, do come to need support. To live and to carry out the activities of daily living. I think, unfortunately, what we do in our models is we take care of the activities of daily living, the washing, the feeding, the medicating, the all that stuff, but that's about it. You could say one way of pointing it out would be to say that a lot of aged care is taken from a human rights perspective, a matter of very serious concern. In that there's not a lot of room, especially in dementia, for the expression of individual preference or choice, not a lot of room to engage in meaningful activity or to be appreciated, isolated, locked away from the community. And I trust the misfortune we have is that we're operating on a set of assumptions about dementia that are completely wrong. We operate as if the person is less and less as the dementia progresses. We operate as though they're not experiencing their life, like they're these shells that we're to take care of and that we're good for doing that. But it's not true. The person with dementia experiences their life just as much as you or I experience ours. It's just because of the brain damage, that experience is distorted and the way they might express their response is distorted. But so we take that as a sign that they're not experiencing properly. You know, and so we then think it's all right to ignore them. And you know, there was one study which suggested that the average amount of human interaction that a person in a dementia facility in Australia got was 7 minutes a day. And so a lot of what we take to be the symptoms of dementia are not per se the symptoms of dementia. The capacity to take initiative, to initiate action, to express will is damaged. So support is needed to be able to engage. So a lot of the things we see as symptoms of dementia are symptoms more of neglect and of the failure of our systems to find a way of life that supports quality of life to look after people in this situation. So we've chosen a place. Sorry, I didn't answer your question. I got on my soapbox. So we chose a place that is awake to that and does their best to do it differently. Small cottages, they do have routines, but everybody doesn't have to comply. It's like their guidelines. And if mum doesn't want to get up for breakfast, they'll wander in later and see if she'd like breakfast on a train bed. It's not more expensive. It's not accomplished through extra money. It's accomplished through different thinking. And that's the challenge ahead of us for dementia, is to change our thinking.
As you know, your mother wrote her own book, which
yes.
I read, and I thought was very good, actually. I thought it was an interesting book of tracing her life. Did she do all of that herself, or was she helped with that? And how much use did you make of her book in your own book?
She wrote it herself. She wrote it in close collaboration with her editor, Di Gribble, who sadly died late last year. And one of her good friends, who I mentioned in this book, did little bits of research like date checking and fact checking, that sort of stuff. But Mum wrote it herself. I happen to think Mum's a very good writer. She has a good naturalistic writing style. I say that she and my brother are the best writers in the family.
Well, I said your mother's book, in the Sitting on Herald, I said your mother's book was better written than your father's book.
I think it's much
not
more...
not a criticism of your father, but I thought your mother's book had a personal element to it.
Yes. She has a very accessible, almost conversational style of writing, whereas Dad derives from an academic style. And I have the same trouble, because when I go to write, I tend to get too wordy and academic. So over the process of the two books, I've really enjoyed working with an editor who gives me strike-through editing, not just... And then grappling with getting the language more accessible. And I felt I accomplished that reasonably well, this book. Because depending on... You know, academic stuff is fine for certain sorts of speeches or writing, but... not very engaging for a biography. I think Mum's style is engaging. The use I made of it was some people writing a biography when the person is not available to them as a source because either they've died or, in Mum's case, was inaccessible by virtue of her dementia in terms of memories and stuff. They have a terrible time just putting together the plot. And the value of Mum having written her autobiography was that the timeline of events was there and certain of her expressed views about them. But it ain't, you know, it's 20 plus years old and she got the ending wrong. And you bring very different concerns to a biography than I think you can to an autobiography.
Got the ending wrong, yeah.
She sure did. But right in the book, she... after I'd written the book and the manuscript had gone to press, but before it came out, I was over at my sister's and she's got Mum's hardback copy of My Own Life. And Mum used to write notes while in doing it. She's always writing notes, and I talk about it later in the book. But I turned to the last page of the book and she'd written a new ending. And I quote part of that in this book.
I think that's a great spot to end on. So many thanks. Take a seat for a second.
Thank you.
Well, I interviewed Hazel Hawke for a Four Corners program I did on Bob Hawke, and she interviewed very well. I was very impressed with Hazel Hawke. I thought she was very practical, very direct, and she, the interview she did extremely well. It was 1994, from memory. It was at the same time that your father's book came out, that his major book came out.
93, 94.
Yeah. So, thanks for today. It's Bob Hawke, without any exaggeration, is clearly one of Australia's most successful prime ministers, without question. I would say, along with John Howard, our most successful prime minister. And Hazel Hawke was a very important contribution to the Hawke enterprise. And it's important that she wrote her own book and that you've come along and written a book about her now that she can't write her own book anymore. So you've done extremely well tonight. The copy's down the back of Hazel, My Mother's Story. But congratulations on what's now your second book in this area, and but with also a lot of important social comments about dementia. But there's also your mother's story, which is a story well before she became ill. And that's the important part in this book, as well as the other part. So congratulations and well done.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.